everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 30-second podcast. My name is John Zagluel, owner and operator of this site. We have a lot to get to today, covering all of Chicago's sports teams and most specifically, the NFL draft coming up later this week. We've also got a very special guest, somebody who is a former NBA champion and someone who will be participating in this summer's Big Three basketball tournament. All of that and more, but first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on LinkedIn and Instagram at JohnZax and on Twitter at JohnZSports. Also, if you're looking for a place here in the local area to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for both adults and children, check out the Arts and Crafts Studio by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. You can find them at the Tinley Park Down Shopping Center at 7913 West 171st Street here in Tinley Park, Illinois. If you have any questions, feel free to give them a call at 708-247-2100. Again, that's 708-247-2100. Well, as I just alluded to a moment ago, the Bears and the NFL draft is happening this weekend, and it's a very important one for the team as they have the number 8 overall pick and they have a chance to really add an important piece or two to their already brightened young core. But I will say this, and I know it's sort of a generalization, but hear me out. I think one thought that is going through every Bears fan's mind right now is Ryan Pace. Please do not screw this one up. We all know in the past how the Bears have been when it comes to drafting players. They've made many poor choices. Kevin White, a perfect example, and you can argue that Leonard Floyd has not necessarily lived up to his potential as well. This year, with the number 8 overall pick, the Bears have to be smart right now and draft someone who they know is going to contribute at a high level. Now, personally, I would love to see the team draft a new quarterback because, as I have mentioned vehemently many times in the past, and including in some articles I've written on my website, I really do not believe in Mitchell Trubisky. I don't see the return or the yield that everybody else seems to see. Now, hopefully, he can prove me wrong because I want the Bears to succeed. But if, in an ideal sense, the Bears were looking for a quarterback, I would say draft high with guys like Josh Rosen, Baker Mayfield, and Sam Darnold. All three of those players have the potential to really make an impact in their first or second years here in the NFL. And that's not even considering that there are other quarterbacks too that not many people are talking about. Josh Allen from Wyoming, and of course, my guy Lamar Jackson from Louisville. Both of those guys as well could make very big contributions early on for whatever NFL team decides to draft them. So, of course, although the Bears aren't necessarily going to be looking for a quarterback, I really wish they did, because this year's class is quite interesting and quite strong, I might add. This year's specific quarterback class really makes me think about last year and what the Bears did and how they drafted Trubisky. Think about this for a moment. At the time, Jay Cutler was on his way out. He was out the door. Chicago wanted nothing to do with him. He was hurt, the Bears had to use a rotation between Brian Hoyer and Matt Barkley, and that was a problem. So with all of that going on, all those on-the-field issues at quarterback, I feel that management, Ryan Pace specifically, felt pressure from the fan base and from others inside the organization to draft a quarterback last season, no matter what the cost. It didn't matter if the year after there would have been a stronger quarterback class. What mattered is at that moment, the Bears needed a quarterback. So at the time, with Mitchell Trubisky being the consensus best player in last year's draft as far as the quarterback position goes, Ryan Pace took a chance on him and decided to take it. But if you compare Trubisky to this year's class with Rosen and Darnold and Mayfield, I don't think he necessarily stands a chance. And it's a shame because if the Bears had the number 2 pick this year, I feel like they could have gotten a better quarterback out of it rather than Mitchell Trubisky. I think what I'm trying to say here is that the Bears settled. They had an opportunity to draft a quarterback. They had the number 2 pick. They were so worried about the backlash from other people, fans, people inside the organization and the media, because everybody knew that they needed a new quarterback. So because they feared all of that, they settled for Mitchell Trubisky. I think that if they could have waited one more year, done even worse considering that they started a backup this season. For example, let's say if the team decided to start Glennon all year this year because they didn't have Trubisky in a hypothetical situation, the team decided not to draft Trubisky last season. So they started Glennon this year. The team would have done worse. They probably could have ended up with the first through third overall pick and drafted a very good quarterback, one in this draft class. But instead, the team settled due to pressure. So keeping all of that in mind, my main argument is, although Mitchell Trubisky is on the team, I feel like the Bears settled to take Trubisky. And now they're going to miss out on a very good quarterback class and have to draft at another position which they have a need. Now, luckily enough, according to the mock draft here on NFL.com, compiled by Charles Davis, the Bears are supposed to take Quentin Nelson with the 8th overall pick, an offensive guard from Notre Dame. Nelson, most arguably, is considered the greatest offensive lineman prospect of his generation. I mean, people are comparing him to someone like a Joe Thomas, who lasted in the NFL for over 10 years, did unbelievable, and is most likely going to be a Hall of Famer. To further my point, think about the Bears, assuming they drafted Nelson on their offensive line. Cody Whitehair at center, Kyle Long at right guard, and then Nelson at left guard. That is an all-pro offensive line for Mitchell Trubisky. That is very good protection for him. And then keep in mind, that'll also benefit Jordan Howard on running. Howard is already a stud in his own right. Two straight 1,000-yard seasons to start his career. Imagine having Whitehair, Long, and Nelson as his main three linemen. He might go for 1,500 yards. Who knows? So having Nelson provides immense benefits for the Bears this year. And I feel like that if I had to make a prediction on who the Bears would draft this year, I think without question it is going to be Quentin Nelson. He just provides so much for this team, and compared to the other players whom the Bears are quote-unquote projected to draft, he makes the most sense. Now, according to Ryan Pace, however, this was just released today, there are 8 players on the Bears shortlist with their 8th overall pick. So, of course, Pace believed that there are 7 other players, not including Nelson, who are worthy of the Bears pick. But personally, looking at all of those options, I feel like Nelson provides the most upside for this Bears team. And if they take him at number 8, I will be one happy camper, to say the least. And with that, we'll move now from the gridiron to the basketball court and talk about some Chicago Bulls news. Obviously, the season is over for the team, but we want to look at some players who really impacted them this year and also talk about the NBA draft. We'll do that first. Right now, as far as mock drafts go, many of them still projecting the Bulls to draft Trae Young. A couple of them, though, now are projecting them to draft Mohamed Bamba. Bamba, in his only year at Texas, averaged 13 points per game and 10 rebounds in 29 games played. And a lot of people highly regard him due to his 7'9" wingspan. That is just a freak of nature right there. I mean, talk about an athlete. So, 2 different options for the Bulls right now. They could go big guy and have Bamba compliment Lauri Markkanen. And by the way, what a tandem that would be for the power forward and center position. Or they're going to go for a point guard or shooting guard and have somebody compliment Chris Dunn and or take his position. Trae Young, I believe, would have a very good opportunity at taking Dunn's position early, but that is risky considering how well Dunn did this year. Keep in mind, Dunn is very young. This season was only his 2nd year in the NBA, and he really turned it on with the Bulls this year. Should the Bulls draft Trae Young and have him take over Dunn's position, leaving Dunn out in the dust, or should they draft someone like Bamba, a guy who can complement Lauri Markkanen and get regular minutes in games, not necessarily replacing anybody important? And I feel like the Bulls really do need a center as well, considering that Robin Lopez isn't getting any younger and it isn't getting any better, to be quite frank. And also, Cristiano Felicio is not the answer anyways. So with those 2 players as your best centers, I feel like the team really needs to make that investment in a big man. Mo Bamba provides all of that. Marvin Bagley the same. The problem with him is, though, is that he is projected to go third or fourth overall. So it's going to be very tough for the Bulls unless they trade up to have any chance of getting Bagley. Luckily for the Bulls, though, they have some time to figure this out. The draft is not coming up anytime soon, so they have time to think it over and weigh their options, and also think about trading up if there's somebody they really have their eye on. But I wanted to shift over, talk about some players who did well this season, and talk about some guys who could really contribute come next year. And the first is Lauri Markkanen, rookie from Finland, played at Arizona last year in college, had a great rookie season. Had 1,033 points and 508 rebounds. He is one of the only Bulls rookies in history, I believe there are three, who have gotten 1,000 points and 500 rebounds in their rookie season. As far as averages per game go, 15 points, 7.5 boards, 1.2 assists. So Markkanen, in his first year, really impressed. And that's good, because at the very beginning, when the Bulls decided to draft Markkanen, there was a lot of heat around that move. A lot of people weren't happy because the Bulls had passed on maybe some more athletic players, like Dennis Smith Jr., for example. I mean, I remember listening to some sports talk radio here in Chicago, and they were talking about how the players in the draft, they did a poll of themselves on who's the best, who's the most athletic, who's the most versatile, and Markkanen got no votes, and they were freaking out, these hosts, because the Bulls ended up drafting him, and there were guys after Markkanen who got more votes amongst their peers. But Markkanen really proved everybody wrong this year. By doing so well, by averaging the 15 points and 7.5 boards, he proved that he is worthy of playing in the NBA and of being effective. Those are very good statistics for a rookie and very good statistics for just an everyday player, especially in today's league. Hopefully Markkanen will continue to improve and we can see some slightly elevated numbers next year in his sophomore season. Next is Chris Dunn, who we just talked about a moment ago, and Dunn, what a year he had considering what I had thought of him and what my perception was of him when he came here in that trade for Jimmy Butler. Last season in Minnesota, averaged 3.8 points per game. Now granted, he did get 17.1 minutes per game on average, but still, 3.8 points per game, 2.4 assists per game. I thought he was a total bust considering he was a first round pick of the Timberwolves last season. He was supposed to be good. And when he came here to the Bulls, I had nothing but mean spirits for him. I mean, I was just totally down on the guy. I did not expect him to do what he ended up doing. And what he did was impressive. 13.4 points, 6 assists, 2 steals, and 4.3 total rebounds per game. That is amazing. Dunn has thoroughly impressed me, and I'm very excited to see what he can do next season. What I view Dunn as is someone similar to a Rajon Rondo, except he has the ability to score, which makes him 10 times better. Sure, Rondo has that gift of passing, the assists and the steals, but number one, he's a cancer to any team he goes to, and number two, the guy cannot shoot nor score if his life depended on it. Dunn is not necessarily a cancer, at least from what I've heard, and he is leaps and bounds ahead of Rondo in regards to scoring. I mean, this guy's averaging 13.4 points per game. I think Rondo's high in his entire career is like 12. So Dunn reminds me of a Rajon Rondo, yet better. And that's something the Bulls need, a guy who can manage the game, who can dish out assists and set plays up for his team on offense. That is somebody that the Bulls need, and luckily enough, they have him. And for my final player, I wanted to take a look at Bobby Portis. Now, Portis, a very interesting case, because we all remember the altercation that happened between him and Mirotić before the season even began. He was suspended for 8 games. It was a team-imposed suspension, but once he came back, he just had a fire with him. He had a fire in his heart and in his eyes, and he really wanted to succeed. And sure enough, he did. Portis this season averaged 13.2 points per game and nearly 7 rebounds per game. Keep in mind, this was primarily in a bench role. He played in 73 games, only 4 starts, was averaging only 22.5 minutes per game, averaging 13.2 points and 7 rebounds. That's amazing. Looking at his totals, 964 total points in 1643 minutes played. That is impressive. A guy nearly scoring 1,000 points primarily in a bench role. So Portis, for some reason after that fight, he really got things cooking and turned up his performance. He's starting to play like the Bulls envisioned he would when they first drafted him back in the 2015 and 16 season. Hopefully for Portis, he can continue this trajectory, and if he can get some regular minutes, some regular starts, we could maybe see some elevated stats like 18 to 20 points per game and maybe 10 rebounds per game. Who knows, he could be averaging a double-double next year if he is in the starting rotation. With that, we'll move on to baseball, starting with the Chicago Cubs, and then we'll go to the White Sox as well, both teams in season. Right now for the Cubs, they're 11-9, close to the division-leading Cardinals at 13-8, but it's okay right now. I mean, we're still nearing the end of April, lots of baseball left to be played, but it's good to see the Cubs get to two games over 500 because as the year began, there were numerous problems for them. I mean, they were 500 as of only a couple of days ago. So it's nice to see them start to break out of their slump, if you would say, and get back to baseball. Right now, some early key players so far for the Cubs this year. Javier Baez is number one on that list, hands down. He has really heated up this year. 7 homers, 23 RBIs. And as far as the Major League leaderboard goes, the leader right now for home runs is Mike Trout, who has 9. Baez at 7 already. And the leader for RBIs, Didi Gregorius at 24. And Baez already near him at 23. I mean, he is having just a monstrous offensive output here in the month of April. He needs to keep that up for this team to keep winning because right now he has got the team on his shoulders. Which is impressive, because I can say this, I would have never thought when the season began, or even in the offseason, that it would be Javier Baez carrying this team, and not guys like Chris Bryant or Anthony Rizzo. Bryant so far this year, by the way, doing well, hitting .319. The problem with him, though, is he got beamed in the head a couple of days ago. Luckily, he's doing okay, but still a bit rattled from that injury, so he'll be delayed day-to-day so far as coming back in games. Bryant, though, .319 with 2 homers. Another guy to keep watch for is Kyle Schwarber. Wow, how do you like that? He's finally starting to heat up, hitting .293 with 4 home runs. I was right for a minute there, though. He didn't start off so hot, but right now, in the midst of a hot streak. As I mentioned, that .293 batting average is unbelievable. If he was able to keep that up for the entire season, my entire perception of Kyle Schwarber would change for the better. Unfortunately, however, I think we all know that eventually that average is going to go down. Now, as far as his power output goes, I feel like he can hit 30 home runs this year if he continues at the pace that he is at. The problem for the Cubs right now is the starting rotation. The only pitcher even doing semi-decent is John Lester with an ERA of 3.10 and a 2-0 record. Everybody else's ERA is extremely high. Hendricks not necessarily at 4.09, but Darvish at 6.86 and Quintana at 7.78. Those two specifically really need to work out the kinks because they are going to be important pieces of this rotation. I mean, my goodness, these two guys are perennial all-stars. They're very good starting pitchers, and right now they're not performing like it. They need to get things figured out, and very quickly, because the Cubs are going to be relying on them to produce at least a good, if not great, output come season's end, and even come mid-season, in the thick of the pennant race. So those two guys really need to work it out in order to help out this team. Before we finish our Cubs talk today, I'd just like to give some props to Brandon Morrow. My goodness, what a job he has done so far as the Cubs closer. A 0 ERA, 7 innings, 7 strikeouts, 4 out of 4 in saves and save opportunities. For anybody who doubted that Morrow would be an effective closer because, oh, he was just a setup man last year. He wasn't the closer for the Dodgers. Kenley Jansen was. You were all wrong. Brandon Morrow has done an excellent, if not better, job than even Wade Davis did at this time last year. So kudos to Brandon Morrow for getting it done out there and living up to the money that the Cubs paid him. Moving on to the South side, talking about the Chicago White Sox now. Right now, looking at the AL Central, they are tied for last place, a 5-15 record. The other team down there with them, the Kansas City Royals. And right now, some interesting yet scary news coming out of the White Sox organization. Danny Farquhar, one of their relief pitchers, is currently in the hospital with a serious brain injury that has had him cheat death multiple times. Luckily, he is still alive today. But what happened is, a couple of days ago, while in the dugout and with no apparent cue or anything like that, he just collapsed. He went to the hospital and was diagnosed with a brain hemorrhage. There was bleeding and blood clots in his brain. They had to perform emergency surgery, and right now, he is still in stable but critical condition. A very scary time right now for Farquhar, his family, and the White Sox organization. I can only hope that he will make a full recovery. Farquhar, too, not a bad pitcher. He could have really helped this Sox team at this point eat up some innings out of the bullpen. So this is obviously a loss for the White Sox, but also a very scary situation. We all hope that he ends up making a full recovery and can make his return to the mound very soon. Looking at the team as a whole, here are some key players, some guys who are starting off and doing very well right now. Jose Abreu being one of them. He is such a model of consistency for this team, and he's doing it again this year, hitting .308, 6 homers, 12 RBIs, and OPS of .942. The thing that I really like about Jose Abreu is that he is just such a model for consistency. Every year, here in the majors, since he's come from Cuba, he's hit at least .290, has hit at least 25 home runs, and has flirted with the 100 RBI mark every single year. And he's on pace to do that again this year, based on his stats so far here in the month of April. So good for him to really power this White Sox team. I know there are not a lot of bright spots for them right now, but he is definitely one of them. Another guy who is starting to turn it on now as the weather is starting to get a little warmer is Yoan Moncada. As recently as a few days ago, I was declaring him as a bust. I really didn't think he was living up to the expectations. But as of late, he's been on a surge at the plate, now hitting .240, which can be improved upon, but has 4 home runs, 10 RBIs, and an OPS of .838. So nice to see him starting to bounce back and rebound. On the rubber, Reynaldo Lopez is impressive, and I called this before in a podcast about a month ago when we were talking about some previews for the year. I said Lopez is due for a big season, and although he has an 0-2 record, an ERA of 1.50, 24 innings pitched, 23 strikeouts. Lopez reminds me right now of Jeff Samardzija, like he was with the Cubs. When Samardzija was with the Cubs in 2013, I believe, he went 2-7 in the first half of the year, yet pitched to a 2.99 ERA, made the All-Star team. Lopez may not have run support and may have an 0-2 record, but that 1.50 ERA is something to cherish and something to celebrate. Hopefully, he can keep up his production and performance as the season goes along and really improve upon his career statistics. And finally, before we get to our special guest, I'd like to take a look at some Chicago Blackhawks news. Two big news stories right now for the team. First, they signed a new defenseman, Dennis Gilbert, coming out of Notre Dame. Gilbert will be joining the Rockford IceHogs in the American Hockey League. They have clinched a playoff berth, so they are still playing, so he'll get some reps there. In 3 years at Notre Dame, Gilbert had 6 goals and 36 assists in 116 games and helped them reach the Frozen Four the last 2 years and this year's National Championship game. As a sophomore, he was named Hockey East's Best Defensive Defenseman, and a third-team All-Star. He spent the 2014-15 season with the Chicago Steel and had 27 points in 59 games and was named the USHL All-Rookie Team. So we'll see Gilbert contributing next season for sure for the Hawks. A nice signing by them. Nothing that will necessarily break the bank, and a good investment considering that he's been with Notre Dame for 3 years and he's a proven winner. He's helped the team reach the Frozen Four in each of his 3 years there. That is something to be proud of. Hopefully, he can bring that winning culture and winning attitude here to the Hawks, who suffered a down year this past season. And speaking of that down year, a new post came out today. The Blackhawks TV ratings continue a downward trend in this past season. They actually decreased a lot, falling 29%. Only the New York Rangers' 36% drop was larger. So is this something to worry about for the Hawks? Now, I think not, only because of the fact that they had a down year. We all know it, we see it by the record, and by the way they played. I feel like next year, if they could come in rebooted and refreshed, and continue with their magic that has fueled their multiple Stanley Cup championship runs, that it won't be a problem in regards to getting people to watch the games. But I will say this, if the Hawks continue their downward trend, and they start to think about rebuilding, they are going to be losing a lot of viewers. Because, let's be honest here for a moment, everybody, or at least 90% of people who claim they are Hawks fans, hopped on the bandwagon after they won their first Stanley Cup in 2010. Now people are starting to realize that the Hawks are in the midst of a rebuild mode. They're starting to get worse again. They need to replenish and get better in the future. With that all in mind, people may start to think, why am I still watching them? I only joined anyways because of their success and their playoff bragging rights. With this article in mind, though, my main concern is that I hope Blackhawks management realized and saw this article. Because if they were thinking about maybe tearing it all down and starting the rebuild next year, they might want to think again. They need to make it back to the playoffs to get some ratings up before they decide to rebuild. Or else they're going to lose more of their fan base over a shorter amount of time. Rocky Wirtz, John McDonough, and company need to think about this and really decide in which direction the organization is going to go. Do they want a sustained fan base? Do they still want some ratings? Because if they do, they really need to think about waiting on the rebuild. If they don't care and they hope that fans will continue to stay loyal throughout, then they won't have a problem. But this article could have some major implications on the way in which the Hawks handle their team in these upcoming years. So hopefully, we'll see them make the right decision for the organization and for the fan base. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He began his career in 1999 as a member of the Chicago Bulls. After 3.5 seasons here in Chicago, he became a member of the Indiana Pacers, winning the 2003-2004 NBA Defensive Player of the Year Award. After stints in Sacramento and Houston, he became a member of the Lakers, where he helped the team win the 2009-2010 NBA Championship. Today, he runs his own media group, is an assistant coach for the South Bay Lakers, and will be taking part in the Big 3 basketball tournament this summer. Please welcome Meta World Peace to the show. Meta, how are you doing today? Thank you for being on the show. I know it's very early over there on the West Coast, but I really appreciate you waking up and coming on with me today.
Well, absolutely. Thanks for having me. And, you know, it's always a good thing when you could play basketball, you know, for a living and still have the opportunity to have fans and have the opportunity to do other things, and, you know, mostly because of basketball. So I'm excited to be on the show.
So, first off, Meta, I'd like to take a look back at your illustrious NBA career, which started right here in Chicago with the Bulls. Now, at the time, the team had just lost Michael Jordan. The team was in the middle of a rebuild similar to what it's doing today. So, with all that in mind, what was your experience like here in Chicago? And ironically enough, when you left, you truly transformed into a defensive superstar with Indiana. So, how was it like here, and then what changed from you going from Chicago to Indiana?
Chicago had a great time. I was young, had a really good support system. Jerry Krause, Coach Cartwright, towards the end, you know, I came up under Tim Floyd. It was definitely an awakening for me because the pace of the game, the length, the 12-minute quarters, you know, the practice, the intensity, that was all shocking. The lifestyle, you know, everything was, like, real shocking to me. Something I wasn't really prepared for, but it led me to playing a little bit defense in Indiana. You know, it prepared me. I had a great time in Chicago. I probably would have been there for a long time if I could have got some things straight off the court. But overall, very grateful.
So once you got to Indiana, you became a powerhouse defensively, winning the 2003-2004 NBA Defensive Player of the Year Award. You made the All-Star team in 04 as well. So what contributed to your success there? Was it more playing time or less pressure, a new environment? How did you become so good once you left the Bulls and went to Indiana?
Well, I think I was becoming better. I was with the Bulls my first 2 years. Then my second year, I was playing much better. And then by the time I got to Indiana, it was just a byproduct of the work that I put in Chicago with all my fitness coach, Coach Eric, and all the therapy, the physical therapists in Chicago was very ahead of their time. So I was very prepared working with Pete Myers in the summertime, and all that stuff helped me out a lot. You know, a lot of times as a player, you forget to give credit to people who helped you along the way because you tend to think you did it by yourself. I had a lot of great individual training sessions with Coach Cartwright, also Coach Pete Myers. Sometimes DJ Armstrong would come out there and work with us. So it was good.
So while you were in Indiana, there is something that I have to ask you. You did something that really made some headlines. So in a game with the Detroit Pistons, you fouled Ben Wallace with less than 50 seconds left in the game. The incident escalated and turned into a brawl off of the court as you confronted a fan who threw a cup of Diet Coke at you. Now, the incident resulted in an 86-game suspension, which to this day is the longest suspension the NBA has ever handed out. I'd like to hear your side of the story on that issue. Do you regret anything that you may have done at that point?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. And it's often brought up a lot. And it can get old, but I don't mind talking about it. It's something that happened in my life. A big incident that I was a part of. And it's hard to regret a situation like that. You really had no control. The backstory was, John Green, the gentleman from Detroit, he bet the gentleman that I hit when I ran into the stands, he bet $50 that they could hit me with a cup of beer. So when I ran into the stands after I got hit, which nobody really talks about, they just talk about the whole malice, but they don't talk about the detail. It's very important to talk about the detail. So that way, everybody's held accountable, and not just myself.
No, so, definitely.
Right. So when I saw the gentleman raise his hand, and you'll see in a crowd when I run in the stands, you'll see a guy raise his hand, and I thought he hit me, but he raised his hand because he's like, "Oh wow, I lost the bet. I owe you $50, John. John has a sports coat on." So when I see that, I'm like, there's only one person in excitement at this time because nothing else is happening in the game except me getting hit. So I ran in that direction unknowingly who hit me. So it was very irresponsible of me to run in that direction. But I did have an idea that was him. So when I run, you know, John was like, "Oh, wow, he's coming." And John kind of turns his back because he thinks I'm coming towards him. But I'm going towards the guy that he bet. So I was going up there with the intention of not punching, which I didn't throw a punch at that guy. But I did want to shake him really hard and tell him how stupid he is and how dumb you are for hitting me and call him all sorts of names, right? So then, so the guy actually bet $50 that he could hit me. Now, whether I was wrong or right, I had no control over that situation. Like, I could not have been in that stand and saying, "Hey, please don't bet $50 that you're going to hit me with a cup of beer."
Right.
It was out of my control. And that's what, I'm not trying to beg people to realize that, but it's the facts and that's it.
No, yeah, and that's, you know, I didn't know that part of the story as well, and it's so great that you told that because at the same time, you know, that is kind of, I don't know, wrong that people are betting money on throwing a cup of beer at a player like that. I mean, I don't find that tasteful at all. I'm sure you didn't either at the time.
So the gentleman who threw a cup of beer at me, we're friends now, and I didn't find that story out until like 4 years ago.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah, because he told me, when we first started talking, we had multiple conversations. But then this conversation came up late. He actually apologized for the whole event. It was really cool. Even though I lost tons of money, and I lost a lot of endorsements. You know, I'm fine with that. But it was really cool with him letting me know what happened, because I thought I was, like, going crazy. You know, I'm like, I know I didn't run into, I know I didn't do this for no reason. Like, I was already a wild boy. I knew that, very aggressive on the court. But I don't think I ever, like, ran after somebody for no reason. You know, so maybe I was feeling kind of bad for years, you know?
No, yeah,
and,
definitely.
But it was cool to know, like, oh, wow, okay, that's what really happened. Like, you guys are more, you know, at fault than me. So it's cool.
So, you know, after the incident, you know, there are many people who wrote some articles about the incident, stuff like that, and you were really portrayed as kind of like a villain or an instigator. Do you find that fair in that sense? Because, I mean, based on the story that you're telling me here and based on how more details have come out, you know, later on in this process, it feels like you were maybe portrayed a bit unfairly by the media after this incident.
You know, it was unfair. One gentleman got fired from ESPN for calling the fans out. A lot of the stories came against me. I was doing national media, and a lot of national media was against me, you know, and I just said, you know, whatever, you know, I just pretty much moved on. I said, if this is how it's going to be, this is how it's going to be, you know, and it's out of my control. I can't control what somebody writes. I can't control what somebody reports, you know, I can't control decisions that somebody makes. It's not my, I always tell people, it's not my business, you know, I just play, I'm an employee, I'm not an employer, you know, so I can't really control those situations.
So, following the incident and suspension, you were traded to the Sacramento Kings, where your presence prompted the team to go on a 14-5 run, and they made the playoffs. So, what was that experience like for you? I mean, you were mostly responsible for helping that team get out of the cellar, make it into the playoffs as an 8 seed. How was that like for you, and how did you guys succeed at that level down the stretch?
I mean, yeah, that team, Carlos Williamson was a major part. Brad Miller, Mike Bibby, and I was happy that I was able to help that team. I wish we could have played better and done better, but, you know, we did as best as we could, given the circumstances of the team that we had. It was a great feeling. It was a great feeling to kind of get back into the playoffs, you know, after not being in the playoffs, you know, for quite some time. So it was a great feeling.
So shifting your time with the Lakers, in your first year with the team, you won an NBA championship, and that postseason for you was memorable, to say the least. You hit a buzzer-beating shot in the conference finals, and then in Game 7 of the NBA finals, you scored 20 points. Your coach, Phil Jackson, said that you were the most valuable player of that Game 7 game. So, describe being able to win it all. I mean, you were in the league for 12 years, and then finally got your NBA championship. What was that like for you?
It was a great feeling, because it's something I worked really hard for. When you practice, and if you're very competitive, you always believe that you're the best. You know, I always believed that I was the best in the world. The only problem with being the best in the world, or believing you're the best, if you don't play against the best, you're never going to know where you stand. Some guys could have been practicing since they were 8, you know, playing against good competition since they were 8. Maybe you played against mediocre competition, but you got a lot of drive. That was the situation I was in when I got to the NBA. I didn't really know what it took to be the best. So for 10 years, to finally get a ring, it was something that I always wanted. And when I got it, you know, it felt really good. It's my only one. So if I would have missed it that year, I probably don't have one. You know, so, you know, with that being said, you know, I'm very, very grateful.
You know, also while being on the Lakers, you got a chance to play with Kobe Bryant. So I was just curious, you know, how did you guys get along and what was it like to play with him? I know, you know, one of the greatest players of this generation. What was it like playing with Kobe and being able to interact with him like that?
It was great to play with Kobe. It was definitely, I was lucky because I got a chance to learn more about being a competitive player. So now that when I coach, I'm able to give the stories that I got with Kobe, or I learned from Kobe, I'm able to give that to the players that I coach. You know, not many people can say that they've been around greatness like that, and then greatness like myself on the defensive end. So it's really cool. It's a really cool combination that I have, and a really cool perspective that I have on the game. And I'm grateful. I'm going to become a better coach because I was around Kobe so much.
And, you know, speaking of your coaching, I know right now you're the G League coach with the South Bay Lakers. So how's that going for you right now? I mean, making that transition from being on the court for so long, now being on the sidelines coaching a team, what's that experience been like?
Well, the coaching is great. I'm an assistant development coach for the South Bay Lakers. I also have my own basketball club where I'm getting more teams. So I have 3 teams right now. I have a 12 and under team, and then I have 2 men's teams. It's called the Panda Sim Club. People could actually join my club if they download an app. It's called Gradello, Gradello. It's on the App Store. And it's only available for Apple phones, but it'll be available for Android soon. But I say that because I love coaching, and I had to figure out a way I can coach more, and then help other coaches. There's a lot of coaches out there that don't have the experience I have, but they have the drive. And it's a difference when you're in the NBA playing against top-level competition because the strength is different. The determination of the players is different. The speed is different. You know, the ability to play with fatigue is a different level. So as a player, if you never experienced it, or as a coach, if you never experienced it, you're not going to understand. You probably will never be able to coach at an NBA level because there's so much that goes into it. So for me, with my club, I allow other coaches to pick my brain, you know, and to learn more about the game, to help the players, you know. So, yes, I coach a lot nowadays.
And, you know, that's awesome because I know you made some headlines, I think it was 2 or maybe a week and a half ago, when you sent out a tweet and put something on Instagram saying that you were interested in the New York Knicks head coaching vacancy. So I wanted to ask you how your experience and then how your time here with the G League and how your coaching on the side has helped you become ready for an NBA job. And then at the same time, have you been engaged in any serious talks with the Knicks about their coaching vacancy? Could we see you be their new head coach come next season?
Well, I don't think I'll be the head coach of the Knicks. But it was that thing where when I see opportunity, I just want to go after it. And it's really that simple for me. I don't have any experience coaching at the NBA level. I feel I can do the job. But it's not to discredit any of the coaches that put in years and years and years of work, how to run a team, everything from traveling with the team, controlling the team, when you're traveling on the plane, the rules and 2 seconds left in the game, drawing up plays. You know, I take a lot of experience, and the coaches that are out there now, it's not to discredit saying some guy who don't have no experience just going to be able to be a head coach. I'm just saying, like, I love coaching. I coach, when I was playing with the Lakers, I was assistant coach for the girls' basketball team at Palisades High School, so I would go from practice with the Lakers, and I would go coach.
Wow.
And then I did the same thing with Beverly Hills High School, and I did the same thing this year with Hillcrest Academy in Phoenix, traveling with the team, coaching the boys. And I got teams now, and I've been coaching them. So, like, so for me, it's just fun, you know. And it's like, okay, you get a team, and you figure it out, and you win. Like, I don't have to complicate it. If you lose, then you figure out a solution to it.
Well, it sounds like, I'm sorry, you know, when you were talking there, it sounds like, you know, you would be committed to doing something like that, though. I mean, you have a lot of passion about it to where if an NBA coaching vacancy were to come up, I could really see you, you know, being that head coach. Because based on what you've told me here, you're definitely obviously qualified as a player, but then also talking about your commitment level, talking about how much you love it, I mean, you could really exude passion, and I feel like you'd be a pretty good head coach if you asked me.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, for me, the reason I like head coach is because it's a couple reasons. It's fun, for one. And when you're out there as a head coach, you know, you're able to put in things that you basically design. Assistant coach is cool too. So this year I was a development coach. So it's not a thing where I couldn't do both. But it's like, you know, I'm just real honest, you know, and yeah, absolutely, I would love to be a head coach.
So despite all this talk about being a head coach, you technically are still playing as part of the Big Three basketball tournament.
Absolutely.
So how did you get involved in the tournament, and can you tell us a little more about what we could expect this summer?
Well, the Big Three tournament, I'm doing that. Ice Cube wanted me to do it. Steve Jackson asked me, Dream on there asked me, and he said it was a lot of fun. So I'm doing it. I really don't have enough time to actually do the Big Three, but I'm doing it. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to play with your former players on national television, so I'm doing it.
Yeah, that sounds great. And, you know, it's so interesting, too, because this whole concept was just created, you know, very recently. But I think it's genius. I mean, you've got all these NBA legends, including yourself, guys like Kevin Garnett, Allen Iverson, all participating. I mean, that is much must-watch TV, in my opinion. And it'll be awesome to see you on the court with all these other guys just playing some three-on-three. You know, it's a really cool concept.
I mean, yeah, it's great. It's an easy game, not too complicated. You know, one game a week. You know, it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
And, you know, even with Big Three out of the picture, you are still keeping busy with the game. I know on May 12th you'll be hosting a basketball festival in Los Angeles. So what's that all about? Tell us a little more about it.
Yes, I'm excited about the basketball festival. We're working with the Board of Education. All the proceeds from the event is going to the Board of Education. Floyd Mayweather was kind enough to lend his company to my event to bring more celebrities out so we could bring more awareness to the mental health vendors that will be there, the job search vendors that will be there, the education platforms that will be there, the Economic Workforce Department, Development Department of the City of Los Angeles will be there. The YMCA will be supporting 7-Eleven, Bleacher Report, and basically, this event is to bring out the kids. And when you get the celebrities to bring out the kids, we're able to get those kids access to things they never had access to. And then a lot of the vendors don't know how to access the kids that they're trying to help. And a lot of celebrities don't know how to give back because they're so busy with their careers. Often, they want to give back, but they don't know the route to take. So I'm putting everybody in one area. We're going to make a difference.
That is just awesome, I have to say. It's such an ingenious idea, you know, getting everybody involved and really helping out kids who are trying to make it to the next level in the NBA. And that's a perfect segue into my next question. You know, you talked about your app and how you're able to coach up people who are not necessarily as qualified as you. So keeping this in mind, there are some younger listeners, of course, on this podcast. So if you could, you know, give some advice about how they can become, you know, the next big thing in the NBA, or how they can become a great defender like you were.
Yeah, I think the main thing is pushing it. The main thing is, like, playing through fatigue. And when you're running, just keep running. And when you're practicing, when you get tired, don't get tired. It's really that simple for me. I always tell my players, don't get tired. When you choose to play basketball, I always tell my players, you're a slave to the game. You're a slave to the work. You're a slave to the fundamentals. You have no options. You have no other choice but to work hard. You have no other choice but to be confident. You have no options. You know, there's no other option when you're playing basketball but to push it and to win. You know, and if you lose, the next time you must win. And you must keep your mindset like that. Fundamentals are very important. You should have a left and a right hand. You should work on your defense. Everything should be based off fundamentals, you know, when you play basketball. And then when you get fatigued, can you continue with those fundamentals? Because doing everything the right way is harder than doing it the wrong way.
You know, you talked about defense, and I really wanted to ask you this because obviously you are a defensive guru. You were one of the best defenders in the game at one point. What are your thoughts on the NBA now and how it's really transitioning from more of a defensive or, you know, kind of a equality in regards to defensive and offensive production to now simply offensive? You know, nobody's really paying attention to defense anymore, and you being a great defender, you know, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, it really is an art, you know, and having it go away, I mean, that's, in my opinion at least, that's a problem. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's a few good defenders out there. Obviously, and when we played a lot of defenders, I mean, the game is, the business is better for the NBA nowadays. I think because the offense, they opened it up. More people wanted to see offense, so they had to do that. But a lot of defense, it is the art, man. I saw that a lot, you know, maybe more than a few people. Actually, I didn't foul out a lot, but I fouled a lot. But I didn't foul out the game a lot. So, it is the art, and people don't really understand that. You know, they always say Middlewell Peace was aggressive or he was dirty. Well, I wasn't dirty. I wasn't that dirty, or I would have been, you know, ejected from games, game after game after game. I was really good at taking up space. If there's any amount of space that I can invade, I would invade it. If the ball was available for me to take, I would take it. If you wanted to post up, I'm not going to let you post up. If you want to get to the basket, you better go another route, you know? And it was that simple for me. And when I was in my prime, literally, if somebody was to score 2 points, I wanted to jump off the roof. I hate it when people would score it on me. And if you have 7, my job is not to let you get 9. Or if you have 50, my job is not to let you get 52. And that was just my mindset when I played basketball.
You know, that's perfect. And it's so interesting the way, you know, you think like that. And, you know, that brings me to a funny moment in your career. You know, there was a time where Paul Pierce, I believe he was going for a layup or he was doing something, you were defending him, and you actually, you pantsed him in the game. I thought that was hilarious. I wanted to get your side of the story on that.
Well, Paul was playing well, and I was always trying to push the limit. I always wanted to do things and not get in trouble, but almost get in trouble, you know, and that was something where I said, okay, how much trouble can I possibly get in for pulling down Paul Pierce? Sure, to him. And, you know, I didn't get in any trouble. Paul Pierce was scared of the shot because he's a great player. And it was a funny, funny moment.
You know, one thing I had always wondered about you personally had to do with your choice to change names from formerly Ron Artest to Meta World Peace. Why did you decide to do this in the first place? And what prompted you to pick such a unique name? I mean, obviously, you know, walking down the street, you don't hear Meta World Peace a lot. So why did you decide to pick that name, and why did you decide to change it in the first place?
I decided to pick the name because I wanted to do something that I wanted to do. I wanted to have a name that I felt really good with. And, you know, Ronald Artest, my parents gave me that name, so that's cool. But I was older, and I'm like, okay, I want a different name. And I had so many different names that I was looking at, but Meta was picked by me and then a lady I worked with, and then World Peace was picked solely by me, and I thought it was cool. It was a little bit nerve-wracking because it changed your name, but, you know, I did it.
And another aspect about your personal life that I found interesting was your situation when growing up. I mean, you began your life in the housing projects of Queens. You witnessed the murder of a fellow basketball player on the court when young, yet rose all above that to become the player and the person that you are today. So how did you manage to overcome that situation to make it big time in the NBA?
Well, I didn't witness the actual murder. It was an idol of ours. His name was Lloyd Newton. And he was everybody idolized him because he was a really good basketball player. And they were away at a playoff game. In that game, he passed away. He got hit with a table leg, went through his heart. It was a riot. So when we found out that Lloyd Newton died, we were young, so it was kind of like a blur, but it was kind of unreal. But you don't really understand how unreal that is as a 13-year-old kid. You're just like, oh wow, he died. You know, you know, it's a situation where he was one of the best players in our neighborhood. I grew up pretty similar to a lot of other people, so I don't make a big deal out of it as much as I used to. But yeah, I grew up similar to a lot of other people who grew up in housing, for federal housing. And somehow I made it out, and I'm not in jail.
Oh, that is just, it's an amazing story, really, and it's great, you know, that you turned out the person that you are today. So I noticed through your Instagram, by the way, that you are going to be starting your own podcast called Moments with Meta. I'd love to talk more about that. You know, tell me, what could we be expecting from that?
Moments with Meta is going to be fun. It's with Steve Weiss. We built it together, and I'm excited about it because I do like to talk. I do like to market myself. I do like to tell stories and talk about issues, and not just basketball. You know, I want to talk about education. I want to talk about injustice. I want to talk about defense. I want to talk about food. You know, I want to just just talk about a lot of different things. Eventually, we'll put it on video. I want to interview people, and not just celebrities. Like, I want to interview families, people that's not known. I want to just tell stories, and I'm really excited about Moments with Meta. I tried it before; it didn't work. I'm hoping this time that it lasts a long time.
That's awesome. It's great to hear. And on a final note, I heard that you are an expert checkers player and have never lost a game in your life. So is this true? And why checkers? You know, I'd love to hear that story.
Obviously, when you get older, you got kids, more responsibilities. You can't play video games as much. You're doing more, you know. But I do like to play. Well, one of my favorite games is bingo. I love bingo. I mean, I wish I could play card games and bingo games and board games like all day, but it's just not the reality.
Well, Meta, thank you so much for being here on the show. I mean, it was a pleasure and an honor to have you on today.
It was a great interview. I really appreciate you having me on the show. I think the questions were, you know, great, and it would give people more of an insight. We didn't hide any stories, but we told it like it is. I thought it was great. Appreciate you, and have a good day.
Thank you. What an honor it was to have Meta World Peace on today's show. I was talking to him after the interview. I told him, you know, I looked up to him as a basketball player when I was younger, watching the NBA, watching those late night West Coast games when he was on the Rockets, the Kings, and the Lakers, you know. It was awesome, just a surreal experience to have him here on today's show. And he told some great stories, too, about him coaching, his life growing up, his checkers addiction, and more. So really an honor to have him on today, and glad he was able to take the time to come on the show. We're going to finish up today with two closing segments. First, the new one, the Twitter poll of the day. So this is something new that I've been working on, but what I did is I put out a question on Twitter and had some people vote on it to see what they thought. So the question was, what position should the Bears look to improve upon in the NFL draft? 51% of respondents said the offensive line, which coincides with my prediction that the Bears should grab Quentin Nelson. 28% wide receiver, which makes sense considering that the team has just lost Cam Meredith. 15% said other, and there are 5% who say quarterback. Hey, it's not out of the question just yet. So that was your Twitter poll of the day. And now, time for my favorite segment, the announcer's call of the day. In honor of Ron Artest being on today's show, we have a clip that exhibits a great play from his career. So let me set the scene. Lakers versus Suns, series tied 2-2 in the conference finals. Now, the clip in its entirety shows Meta World Peace, named Ron Artest at the time, take a three with a minute to go, but he missed. And that was during the fact that a new shot clock was just given to the Lakers. So the broadcaster here, Marv Albert in this case, wonders why he took the shot. But in the end, Artest makes up for it with an unbelievable buzzer-beating layup that sends the crowd home happy. So here's the call from Marv Albert. It's about a minute long. Let's take a listen.
On Saturday night, Artest with the shot clock rolling down. Gasol with the lead by Artest. Three, why would he take the shot?
You're asking me. I mean, that's a terrible play. You got a brand new shot clock. He's now 1 of 8. That's exactly what the Phoenix Suns wanted him to do. Gasol, they get a new shot clock. And I'm even looking at Phil Jackson saying, what are you doing taking that shot?
Five, that's it. Richardson again for the tie. Yes! He makes it home!
opportunities for the Suns, and Jason Richardson goes last.
Aaron Dudley defending on Bryant. Both teams are over the foul limit. Odom will throw in. Bryant turns and comes up short.
What a shot there by Ron Artest. At the time, there were 3.6 seconds left. Kobe Bryant put up a three. It was no good. Artest gets the rebound, banks it off the glass as the clock hits zero, and the Lakers win the game. It was what a shot there by Artest, and again, awesome to have the now-named Meta World Peace on today's show. Well, with that, it's time for us to close here at Sports Talk Chicago. Thank you all for listening. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Instagram and LinkedIn at John Zags and on Twitter at John Z Sports. A special thank you to Meta World Peace for coming on today's show. What an honor it was to have him on here today. Thank you all again for listening and have a great day.